Hi, welcome to our podcast. This is a podcast that we developed with the Parent Voice Group at the Greenhouse and really came out of an idea of wanting to know what was going on with our children, what were in their brains, and trying to understand a little bit of the science to try and help us make sense of what was going on. You're going to hear lots of different voices, lots of different parents, and just remember, we're all at different points in our journey. We know each other really, really well. So if you hear us laughing, I promise you it's not weird and I don't want you to feel intimidated. I think you should be really proud that you've made it this far. It is going to be quite intense in places. So once you've done listening, dip in, dip out as you need to. But once you've done listening, go and make yourself a cup of tea, have a breather and just reflect on what you've listened to. There's no right or wrong answers here. If you've forgotten bits later on, you can always dip back in and pick up where you left off. You can also do it while you're walking the dog, while you're doing the housework, or simply going for a drive. And if you want to share it with friends and family so that they can take different parts from it too, that's okay. We really hope you find it useful. And if you're feeling brave and you want to come and see us and do the doorstep mile, we promise we don't bite. There's always tea and cake, and there's always a listening ear to help you along the way. Lots of helpful videos online. So don't find it intimidating. If you can stick with it, hopefully you'll find some really useful information that will help you and your child on the first step of your healing journey. And you're playing such a huge part in their recovery that you should be really proud that you're able to do something practical to help them too. So have a listen, sit back, make yourselves comfortable, and we hope to see you soon. Initially, after disclosure, your whole world is turned upside down. You don't know how this has happened, what's happened. Your child's doing things that you don't expect them to do. Their behaviours may be quite challenging. You're trying to manage all these things, all these professionals and people coming into your life. And I think what helped was trying to understand the why, what's happening, to help me as a parent manage the what. So this kind of science bit is quite difficult to get your head around, but really, really important, because if you can understand how the brain functions, you've got a better shot at supporting your young person through that journey, and also yourself, and also being able to advocate for them at school and in different settings as well, because nothing makes sense, and what you're trying to do is work out, what can I do? This is something you can do, which is try and understand it, because that will inform how you parent going forward.
I think for me, I didn't react in a way I thought I would have reacted. You always hear people say, oh, if this happened to me, I would do that, or if anyone touched my child, I would do this to them. And I don't think any of us did actually react that way. None of us are, you know, up in court for manslaughter or anything like that. We've all responded in ways that you, thinking about now, you're thinking, well, why did I do that? Why didn't I do this? And yeah, I think the way that I probably overreact more now than what I did then. So
you're confused by your response.
Yeah.
Me too.
Because I was actually really calm.
Yeah, I think kind of the other thing was, for me, it was normalising the behaviours that I saw in the context of trauma. So perhaps behaviours that I saw that I thought were really off the wall, actually, in the context of trauma, made complete sense. So that's why it was important to understand science a bit.
Yeah.
So we are all here because something has happened to our children that no one was in control of. It's something that doesn't get spoken about. It is a massive taboo. You know, and talking about trauma because of sexual abuse is just not something that's spoken about. So for us to be here now, because we have all lived through it, we've helped our children through it, and we're now sat here trying to help you through it. So forgive us if we kind of go off on different tangents, but that's kind of how we all function, and it's how we've worked as a team over the last 18 months.
I think you make a really good point as well about, because it's so taboo and people are isolated with it and stuff, we don't necessarily have access to the information that might be useful to understand. And I guess that's, you know, why, like, yes, there's a few sciencey bits in this one, but that's why it might be useful to understand those things, because why would we know them otherwise, yeah. You know? So, yeah, that's...
It's not just for now, though. It's understanding the now, but it's then how the journey goes forward. You know, it's different things. We've all got different experiences today, tomorrow, yesterday. So this bit is the kind of the foundation of what you need to try and get your brain around so that you can support your child going forwards, I guess.
Yeah, so if we do the bit of the kind of the sciencey bits about the brain and what happens and how it impacts on the body, and bear with that, so we've got the basic information, and then after that, it's probably important to think about, like, what trauma is. Yeah, what it means to people.
What comes to mind when you hear the word trauma?
I think my view of what is trauma is different now than it was before.
Mm-hmm.
I think we thought about trauma as being, I don't know, you hear in America, don't you, the trauma room, and it's a broken leg and it gets fixed and then we all go on our way, you know, but it's not. It's physical, it's emotional, it's, you know, really, it can be all consuming, I suppose, and it's particularly in respect of sexual abuse, is very, very internalised by your family, you know, into your family rather than the rest of the world. Like, if you walk around with a cast on your arm and you've got a broken arm, it's very visible. What we see with our children, I think, is very, can't think of the word that I'm trying to go for, you know, it's very internal, it's very private, I suppose. And that, again, is sort of at odds with wanting to break the taboo. You have to talk about it, but in talking about it, you're kind of talking about it.
It's almost like a hidden disability, isn't it? Where, you know, there's things going on, and you know there's things going on with your child or within yourself, but you may not be able to speak about that with friends, family, or work colleagues, and so you just feel like you're fighting these emotions and that all on your own, with no one to talk to, no one that's going to understand, because they also haven't experienced that level of trauma. So how do you begin to explain when you don't know how you're feeling yourself?
Yeah. Well, I think it causes trauma for you as a parent as well, doesn't it? So you kind of, you can use the same model to think about the way that you're responding to things. So, and I think I used to find that quite useful, because I know that I used to dissociate and kind of, it was like watching someone else living my story, because that was the only way that I could cope with it on a daily basis. So understanding it. But also, I think kind of when you're saying about, like, talking about it as well, I remember when my daughter originally disclosed, she wanted to talk about it, but she wasn't allowed to, because it was an active police investigation. So actually not, and then being told off for talking about it, and now people want her to talk about it, it's really tricky.
Whereas I would have wanted my child to, you know, open up or talk about, you know, how it was affecting them, because I knew how it affected me, and I went into that fight mode, so I was kind of just continuing as normal. But I didn't know if that was the right thing for my child, so I wanted them to be able to talk. And we did find a way in the end of going for a nighttime drive where I was able to concentrate on the road. So because my focus wasn't on them, they were then able to talk open, and, you know, it was just the two of us.
We often did that park bench ride quite well,
okay.
Side by side.
And it's a very individual thing, trauma, isn't it? That, you know, I think that we're so used to kind of comparing and ordering and, you know, trying to get your head around that there is no hierarchy, that what impacts one person may not impact somebody else, or what one person can cope with, another person can. And I think that adds to like that, the kind of secrecy and the isolation and the shame if you're thinking, or you've even been told by somebody perhaps that, oh, well, it's not as bad as that. It could have been as bad, you know, worse or you know, whatever situation. But actually, trauma is about your experience of something and how it impacts you, not on the actual act or thing that has happened to you necessarily. And I think it's important to kind of acknowledge that. Yeah, we wanted to talk a bit about trauma and memory because we know that trauma impacts on memory and it can be really confusing, not understanding. Have you kind of had any thoughts or experiences about how you've seen trauma impact on memory?
My memory is shocking, really bad, to the point where I was coming to the greenhouse for parental support, and I didn't even remember coming here. We'd all had this big discussion about having these meetings, and I was like, well, why wasn't I part of that? And they were like, you were. So, yeah, the fact that it has affected my memory so severely is surprising.
Mm. And my daughter's memory now is shot. It's kind of, we do laugh about it now, because I'll say to her, remind me when we get into it, you're asking me. I'm not going to remember. So yeah, and then other times she talks about things like they happened yesterday, but it was actually like years ago. And so it's kind of jumping around in conversation a bit.
I think we found it going through the criminal justice system, that perception that memory is something that is very linear and very locked in, and actually it's not. That doesn't mean your child is not telling you the truth. It just means it's a bit muddled in there. And I think what helped me to understand it was this kind of filing cabinet analogy, where if it's a happy memory, it goes off into its little box and it gets filed away. And you might take it out once in a while and say, that beach trip was nice, or that holiday. When it's trauma memories, it's like a cupboard full of coat hangers. And you open the door and it all kind of tumbles out and you can't untangle anything, you can't put it back. And that kind of journey through therapy, we very much talked about it being like a messy suitcase. And you've got to get out, you've got to get the item out, you've got to inspect it, you've got to understand it, and then you've got to fold it up and put it away neatly. And if you don't go through that process of reordering it, it stays in this kind of jumbled state that doesn't really make a lot of sense, and actually caused a lot of distress to her. Actually, she was really upset by not being able to remember things, or really confused. And if she was, you know, kind of trying to explain to other adults that maybe didn't have the broad understanding that we've got, it can be really combative. And then, you know, fight or flight kicks in and tables get flipped and, you know, all hell breaks loose. But I think the bit about trauma memories being different is quite important to understand, because you react to it in a different way. Well, certainly we did. You know, if you're trying to think about it like a nightmare, you might soothe the child differently. If it's a flashback, it's to them, it's live, it's real, it's happening now, and their body's responding as if it's happening now. And we had to adjust how we try to help her through that, because it just trying to see them saying, go back to sleep, just didn't work. Mm-hmm. But we didn't know it, why it wasn't working, because we didn't understand why it was different, because nobody told you that it's different.
Yeah, exactly that. And I think that timestamp thing is really important for understanding flashbacks. Mm-hmm. Because if it's being stored in the amygdala rather than the hippocampus, it's got no sense of time frame. And so exactly like you say, the flashback feels like it's happening here and now, not in the past. And yeah, that knowing that will change a response potentially.
And it will just change how you deal with your child at that moment in time. And, you know, it might be different the following day. It might, you know, a week later, you might, you know, have something else to deal with. So it just, your child will be individual, and each day will be, you know, new challenges that might be different from like the day before. So
yeah, and I think triggers are an important thing to kind of think about as well, because you know they're really connected to our senses, you know, and it's often sensory things that do trigger. But if, you know, if we think about them triggering a memory, if the memory is not stored correctly, then it's almost triggering the event happening again here and now. And so, yes, some of the behaviours that you see as a response to that might, on the outside, look quite extreme or out of proportion or something, because that person can see there's nothing actually, you know, risky or dangerous around them. But for that person that's experiencing it, they're experiencing the risk and the danger as if it's live and is happening right now, and so their response is absolutely appropriate to survive.
Everything's just dialed up, isn't it? Because they've been living with something quite, you know, difficult and horrific for so long, or however long it is, their natural alert system is just in overdrive the whole time. So it can actually take an awful lot to trigger a complete meltdown for that child or for me, depending on the day. But yeah, it's just understanding that, because I don't think, particularly in school, I don't know how you guys found it, but particularly in school, the teachers not understanding, and not being in the loop, but that's another conversation for another day, but not understanding how trauma memories are different, meant they were trying to discipline rather than support.
Yeah,
absolutely. And if, you know, and that's not necessarily the right tactic with something that a child feels is happening now.
Answer that.
So just reflecting on the difference between nightmares and flashbacks. If it was, you know, we didn't have many nightmares growing up, but we would sort of soothe her back to sleep, rub her back, you know, it's all right, go back to bed, and be confidently able to kind of put her back in her bed and leave her be, and she would go back off to sleep. When she had a flashback, and they were more often at night, but not exclusively at night. They did happen during the day. They did happen at really odd moments that made no sense to me, but made sense to her at the time. It was much more of a active thing. So trying to use a grounding technique, giving her space to talk, if she wanted to talk, no matter what the time is or what was going on or whatever, taking her somewhere quiet, just giving her that space. And sometimes it was a talk, sometimes it was a sensory thing, so giving her something to smell or to chew, and sometimes it was just a hug if she was in that mood. And it was very much child-led, so I wish I could say there was a one-size-fits-all, or if you just do this, it will make it better. But the reality is, you need lots and lots of tools in your kit bag, and it depends on what's going on. And some of them will work today and not work tomorrow. But don't be deterred by that, because what didn't work today might work tomorrow. You know, you just don't know. And the best thing you can do is kind of arm yourself with a broad set of tools and things that you can do, and different things that might help your child to be able to soothe them, depending on whatever curveball they've thrown you today.
We found that bedtime was quite difficult, because I think once your child has gone to bed, then they're on their own with their own thoughts, their own feelings, you know, unanswered questions. So that used to cause quite high anxiety within my child. And I found ways that would comfort them would be if they thought I was upstairs nearby, I would perhaps use that time to do some ironing, put the washing away. So I would constantly be in and out of their room where they could feel my presence. They knew that I wouldn't speak to them, but, you know, he knew that I was there and it was soothing for him. Or I might say, well, I'm going to have my bath now. So he would hear me run the bath or hear the shower going, and, you know, that was quite soothing for them. But then sometimes the anxiety would get so bad, it would turn more into like a panic attack. And I found then that giving them, you know, a little activity to do, you know, just doing a little drawing, or, you know, trying to, you know, do a jigsaw puzzle, that sort of thing, just something that would take their mind away, would help, even if it was just for a couple of minutes, it would just come out of that panic mode.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. And with lots of these examples that you're giving, it's all kind of trial and error of what works. But I think it connects to the different parts of the brain that we've already spoken about and what you need when those bits are active. So actually, if you're really dysregulated and you have flipped your lid and that bit's offline, then doing the kind of reasoning, talking, thinking about it, reflecting on it isn't necessarily going to land in that moment. And actually, you know, the kind of the limbic system and the emotional kind of system of that connecting to somebody, knowing that you're there, around, alongside them, just being with them, you know, doing something that calms or, you know, or kind of regulates themselves, that's what's going to connect to them in that moment. And we talk more about that in the next kind of audio session. So there'll be lots more kind of how to use what we're learning or explaining today in reality, you know, in the next session. You've also, I was just thinking about all the things that you've just said that you've kind of, you know, lots like flipping tables, having panic attacks, running away, shutting down, any of these things. I think it's, you know, like one thing, there are so many different responses you can have to trauma, and sometimes they can be really confusing and frightening. And I, you know, it's always useful, I think, for people to hear that these things don't mean that there's something wrong with you. They're an indicator that something has happened to you, and actually they are normal and typical and useful responses to a traumatic situation. But I think they can be really scary, especially if they come out of the blue. I'm just thinking about, like, you know, the physical, the emotional, the behavioural things that you might see in your children following trauma.
The interesting part is understanding how many physical symptoms. You think of trauma as being something that might affect your mental well-being, but the actual physicality of it, the symptoms that my daughter's been left with now, many years on, six years on, she has developed tics, motor and verbal, and they can be really painful and really involuntary and embarrassing for her. She has issues with concentration. She has issues with noise. There are lots of things around memory recall. She has problems recalling dates and complex information. She has to have really weird things like her worksheets and exam papers have to be in a certain size font on a certain size, a certain colour paper. There are lots of things that you might look at and think those are ADHD traits. And the amount of teachers that say to her, have you got ADHD? No, she doesn't, because these things were not present before disclosure. They weren't there. So it's not, it's, you know, as a result of the trauma, but these are things that she's been left with. They were nightmares, there were headaches, there were issues with incontinence, you know, I could go on and on and on, and all of them sort of worm their way back to the traumatic experience. There are things that we haven't had to deal with, you know, we haven't, you know, had to deal with violence or being overly aggressive, but on the flip side, we've had things like she would hide food and not eat or control what she was eating or, you know, leave a yogurt in her room for 6 months before we found it and I couldn't work out what it was. You know, those kind of things that you take, now we laugh about it because you have to laugh, but so many things that you don't realise can be linked to trauma. And, you know, it's really difficult when there are so many understood conditions in the world and, you know, what she's been left with is complex PTSD, and that does present, actually, there's a lot of crossover with ADHD and the issues that those people kind of have to get over. And the support is there for those people. And if you say, I'm neurodiverse and this is my condition, people understand that when you're dealing with trauma, because you're not really able to talk about the thing that caused it, all of the symptoms can be overlooked. They can be felt to be behavioural. You can face issues with your child, I think, at school being labelled as a troublemaker or being dramatic. We've had all of these things at one time or another. So it's understanding that it's not just the mental side of it is really important for you to kind of get to grips with what you're seeing and being reassured that it's probably somewhere along the line a completely normal response, and hopefully informing yourself about how the brain works might help you to respond in a different way, because your temptation as a parent is to call it as you see it, and if they're being cheeky or they're being particularly challenging, I do it, I still do it now, you know, you get your back up and then you get angry and then you start wagging your finger. It doesn't help. Sometimes you're able to kind of take a step back and think, actually, what is causing this? And sometimes I just ask her and say, what is it? Because what you're responding to might be something entirely ridiculous to me. You know, I've lost a pencil. Whatever it might be, it doesn't matter. To me, it seems really trivial. To her, it's like the straw that broke the camel's back. So
I think it's important as well, the fact that a lot of things that you might find them doing is things that they feel they are in control of, because, you know, the reason why they're going through trauma is because of something that they haven't been able to control. So it's almost like, you know, the reverse of that. Oh, what can I do now? Oh, I can control this. I can control what I'm eating. I can control what food I hide away. I know where that is. It's almost like a safety net for them, isn't it? That's things that they're able to do for themselves when they weren't able to before.
Yeah, that absolutely happened in our house. So just when you think you're dealing with, you know, you get an eating disorder thrown at you, and that's what people think. So to have a child who now stopped eating and hasn't eaten for 28 days, and you've got doctors going, well, just buy the food that she likes, you know, and it's like, no, that doesn't work. So, you know, and it's kind of, and fighting to get her, you know, the management that she needs. And they did deduce, I think, in the end, that it was a period of disordered eating for exactly that reason. So she was trying to control it, trying to control her emotions. Couldn't control her emotions, but she could control what she put in her mouth. So, yeah, and that was pretty hard to deal with, because as a parent, I think, you just feel hugely guilty.
Yeah. Absolutely, and that's, you know, like you've highlighted behaviours, you've highlighted physical things, you've highlighted the emotional things that you see, and it cuts, there's so many that go across all three of those things. And I think that, like, you know, to talk a bit more about survival responses, it can be difficult to understand or see these things as survival responses when you're not seeing a survival situation. And I think if you understand the kind of the brain stuff that happens, because actually what happens in that moment, whatever kind of survival strategy your body and brain deployed, it worked in the sense that you survived, and therefore your brain learns to use it's detecting all the time at a higher rate than it was perhaps before, but also it learns to use those same responses more readily, more easily. It's more tuned into it, and so it starts, and it may be the same ones, it may be different ones in that case, but it's going to deploy a survival response much more readily, because it's in that pattern, it knows it works, it's seeing it, there's danger everywhere. And so, yeah, it might not make sense for, like you say, you know, you've lost your pencil and you're having this kind of response. But actually, if that losing your pencil is triggering something else that feels more deeply connected to your trauma or more, you know, it could mean, well, that means I've got to go and see this person in this room, and that's a danger that I'm detecting. To us from the outside, it can seem irrational or it doesn't make sense. But actually, that brain is absolutely responding all the time, often in survival mode.
The panic attacks at school were really difficult to manage, and they're out of your safety net, so they're in the care of the school. And as hard as they tried, and they did try hard, you know, they weren't terrible people, they didn't get up and think, oh, how can I make, you know, my daughter's life miserable today? But they weren't equipped in the same way to understand the why.
And, you know, I remember vividly having conversations, and they would ring me and say, my daughter would hide. She would run off, and she would hide normally in the toilet, and she would call me. And I work, and that was quite a challenge to manage. And then I'd have to phone the school and say, I don't know where she is, but she's not in a good way. Can you go and find her? And they're like, can't she just make her way to reception? Can't she? And I was like, no, she can't just do anything. In this moment, no, she really can't. And it's trying to get that education across to them that these things aren't trivial to the children, you know, to the children. They're not. And you wouldn't say that to an adult. If you came across an adult in your workplace, in the street, having a panic attack, and they're quite obvious most of the time, they're usually noisy or loud, or you can see that what is happening is not normal. It was really difficult to get them to be empathetic in the same way, because they're not, they're in a system that needs to manage, you know, hundreds of children, and they can only do that with a set of rules. And what trauma does is kind of go, I don't care about your rule book. This is what's happening, and I've got no control over it, and this is just going to happen. And so understanding that helped me to help them understand that, no, she can't just do anything in that moment, and what we need to do is work on stopping it getting to that point. I think the other thing we found really useful was just naming it with her. So once we kind of understood what was going on, even now, you know, we will say to her, you're spiraling, you need to just stop, take a minute. Or if we're having a conversation because she's not emptied the dishwasher or done whatever it is that kids are supposed to do, and she starts to get tense, and you can see the fist clenching and the breathing's rapid, and she's getting quite manic. You know, as long as we're in a kind of calm state as well, we're able to say, just take five. We'll talk about it later. Because if you let it go any further, you're in meltdown.
And is that the point at which she would flip her lid, and that like rational reasoning thinking bit of her brain would go offline, and she'd be purely driven by the kind of the feeling, the emotion stuff?
She's not logical in that moment.
But if you can catch it before it gets to that point, she can calm and
It doesn't always work.
No,
even with the best of intentions, you know. But more often now, she's able to kind of come back. And it might take an hour, it might take 10 minutes, it might take a couple of days before she's ready to kind of have the, and this is what we didn't like about that situation, or how are we going to do things differently? But you need to kind of have that disconnect from the anger and the emotion to be able to get back to the place where you want to be, which is your child understanding what's going on.
Talking about the school thing, because, you know, sexual abuse and that within children is a lot more common than what the average person that hasn't experienced it would dream of thinking it was. The fact that schools just do not seem to be equipped to deal with anything that's out of their kind of like day-to-day rule book, as you've said, I find really, really shocking. Because there are going to be other children within that school that are going through the exact same thing. And going back to the whole taboo, it's because nobody talks about it. But the fact is, there will be a number of children that are having, and parents that are having to deal with this at the same time.
It's not just sexual abuse trauma, is it? If you pair it back to the nuts and bolts of what you're talking about, it affects all sorts of trauma. It could be bereavement, it could be a parental divorce, a separation, it could be a pet that's just died. And it, to us, you know, I had that conversation with my daughter, and she was saying, oh, you know, such and such cat's died, and it's, she knows she's in bits, and isn't it awful? And it's like, but that's the worst thing that's ever happened to her. So to you, that might feel really trivial, but to this young lady, was just like her world had ended, and it's perspective. And I think we need to be really careful about assuming that because it doesn't make sense to us that it's not important to that person in that moment.
Thinking about, you know, also linking the kind of physical symptoms that you've talked about to the kind of the science of the brain and the body, there's a theory which, you know, you can make it way more complicated than we're going to talk about it today. There's much more to it, but it's called the polyvagal theory. And simply, there's essentially a network within our bodies, a nervous network, a nerve network. And what happens is when there's a trauma that triggers a survival response, whether that's fight, flight, freeze, flop, fawn, that will stimulate a particular pathway within that nerve, which connects to all different things within our body. So it may be our skin, our eyes, our temperature, our organs. And if our body detects a fight, that we need a fight response, it will pump blood to our muscles, it will make our heartbeat faster so we can get up and we can energize. And it will essentially equip us to respond in that particular way. And I think it's really important, like you've already highlighted, that this isn't just an emotional thing or just a physical thing. You know, it's all interconnected. So when kids say, I've got a stomach ache, like they actually do have a stomach ache, you know, because of perhaps some of the feelings that they're having. But the pain is real. So we were talking before about one of the impacts of trauma being kind of perhaps responding or reacting differently to things, and maybe things that we used to be okay are now absolutely not okay. And we can talk about that in terms of the window of tolerance and having like this kind of space where we feel regulated and we feel able to kind of manage the general ups and downs of day-to-day life. So it might be that we get a bit upset or we feel a bit low, but it's kind of in a manageable space. And this also connects to what we said about the polyvagal theory of like when our nervous system is in this kind of calm, regulated space, we're kind of just doing okay. And what happens in trauma and after trauma is when we become dysregulated and we're pushed into those like survival responses of like fight, flight, freeze. Actually, after trauma, our window of tolerance, so what we're able to tolerate and manage, shrinks. And it does that because it keeps us safe. So it kind of makes total sense that if we do less things, expose ourselves to less things, if we're getting the message that this isn't okay to be in school, or it's not okay to leave the house by myself, or it's not okay to eat those types of food anymore, you know, it could be all sorts of stuff. It keeps us safe. But what it also means is that we really can struggle with the everyday things that before we might have taken in our stride or not even kind of thought about. Is that something that kind of you've seen play out? And I think that kind of relates also, you know, like in like with your body and your brain and almost your automatic nervous system, like deciding for you. So like how with your rational brain, thinking brain, you'd have gone, oh, maybe I would respond like this, and you actually haven't. And you can see how also that can be really confusing for young people who have been assaulted. And like we talked about before, that our automatic responses don't think about how we're going to feel afterwards. But if afterwards we think, well, why on earth did I do that? Why didn't I do that? Or you've also got this narrative from, you know, other kind of misconceptions of the world. Well, why didn't you run away? Or why didn't you fight? And if our automatic nervous system has detected that that's not how you're going to survive, how you're going to survive is to be quiet, stay still, shut down. That's what you do. You don't get a choice. But it can be really confusing then to look back when you've got your rational thinking brain back online. Why didn't I do this? And that can really then link to all those feelings and big emotions that can come with it, with shame and self-blame and all of that kind of stuff.
You talked about window of tolerance, I mean, and whether you noticed any changes. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. I mean, prior to disclosure, I had a child that was involved in so many after-school clubs. She was really sociable and happy. And our world now is really small, really small. And rarely does anything outside of the house. So, you know, and like when she comes in from school, you absolutely cannot talk to her because she needs at least an hour to decompress, because just holding it all together for the day is enough. Mm-hmm. And so actually, when she comes in, we now know that actually I'm like, hi, see you later. And she'll go and have an hour, and then we can actually decompress. And if she, and that's often what happens, she'll come back and then chat about a day. So
did it take you some time to work that out?
Yeah, it took a while to figure that out. I think I used to get irritated because I wanted to know what was going on at school.
Yeah.
And I would never hear anything, but the time she would choose to tell me, it was generally as I was trying to go to bed about 10 o'clock at night. That's generally when everything needs to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But that's moved forward a bit, and now, I mean, she's matured as well, don't forget. I mean, this journey is long. So we're now 4 years down the line. And so with her maturity as well, I can actually say, do you want to maybe tell me now? Because I am going to go to bed in an hour. So and that works.
I think for me, I'm probably 10 years down the line now. That's if my memory is correct. But yeah, I think I'm probably about 10 years in. And I'm now seeing things that I would possibly relate more to PTSD and things showing signs now, rather than, you know, over the last, you know, few years, or, you know, even after disclosure. Whereas having another child on the autistic spectrum, I was kind of always really aware of the downtime and, you know, allowing your child to kind of decompress, or, you know, go and self-regulate and things like that. So that actually come quite natural to me. Whereas now I'm finding that when there's certain conversations, you know, taking place within the home now, something might come up. And I go back to what you were saying about, it's almost like it happened yesterday. It's when, yeah, and that's kind of just something that I've noticed probably, I'd say, over the last couple of months. And it's been like, okay, so where do I go from here? Because I know my child now needs support again. And we're almost at the age now where he's going to be leaving the child services and going into adult services. So it's, where do you navigate next?
So do you find, that's really interesting you say that, do you find that the kind of, the window of tolerance changes? So you may, it may feel very narrow, and then it may broaden, and you may be kind of like adjusting to a new phase of life and what that brings. And then actually something shifts. It could be like a developmental change or a life change, and then that window of tolerance shrinks again.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you've got to find another way to help broaden and expand again, or, you know,
you remember, this is all going alongside normal teenage development, and that is confusing enough for the young people in itself
and the parents.
Yeah. And I think we found there was a real mixture. I think to begin with, she would go hell for leather at everything. So a bit like you, she'd come home from school, and holding it together in school, she'd crash when she got home, and she would just go to bed. Mm-hmm. And there were days, you know, you go through periods where she'd probably have 10 days, and then she could not physically get out. She was so physically exhausted, she could not get out of bed. So she missed quite a lot of school, and we had to work hard to support kind of keeping up with studies and what have you. Then she'd kind of enter a manic, it was almost a bit, I'm going to use the term flippantly, but bipolar, where she would then go through this manic phase where she would be doing everything, helping everywhere. You know, she would, yeah, she would kind of be into everything and want to do this and want, but she couldn't handle it. And so as a parent then, you're kind of trying to go, you're burning the candle at both ends, you know, taking on this and this and this and this, and now you want to do this. Have you got time for that? You know, and it was quite difficult. You know, and parental guilt, because I felt like she'd missed out on so much. I was kind of like, oh my God, I really need to let her. She wants to do fun stuff. I need to let her do fun stuff. Otherwise, you know, I'm just making everything worse. So it's a real fine balance. And now she's an adult, a real grown-up adult. And I'm still seeing that risk, not risk-taking behaviour. I think there's a real extreme between regression and even now real elements of young behaviours, young
kind of attitudes and, you know, how she is and how fragile she can be and how naive she can be. No sense of danger whatsoever, you know, out and about. She thinks, and I'm trying to work out if she's just a normal kind of teenager or she thinks she knows everything. But generally, she's really kind of quite sheltered. So it's really difficult to kind of go, well, what is teenager stuff? What is trauma stuff? And I don't think you ever get to the bottom of that. So I'm quite honest with her. And I will say, do you know what? If you're keeping things to yourself at the moment, that's absolutely fine. I won't force her to talk to me. But the quid pro quo is sometimes I'm going to get it wrong. And I'm going to call it as I see it. And if I get it wrong, I get it wrong. But we then repair and we come back and we talk about it and we apologise. And, you know, it's, it makes you a different parent, I think.
I completely agree. It was something that I, you know, I would get wrong a lot, and but I was always quick to realise I've got this massively wrong, or I've, you know, I flipped my lid and I shouldn't have. And, you know, we're very good within our house of sitting down, having to explain ourselves because there is a child there on the autistic spectrum. So it is a case of just speaking to them in ways that they understand. And just for me, almost trying to explain, this is why I've reacted in this way. And it's interesting you're saying that, you know, you almost feel like you've sheltered your child, even though the worst thing imaginable has already happened to them. Because that's happened to them, I found then that I didn't want my children to go on sleepovers and, you know, do all these things that, you know, children tend to want to do, you know, even school camps and things. It was all things where the anxiety on all sides, from the parent, from the child, it just made the, I want to say the normal childhood experiences that much more difficult. And you do then try and protect your child in ways that, I don't know what I'm trying to say.
You're trying to wrap them up in cotton wool.
Yeah.
Because you don't want them to be hurt the way they've been hurt, and because you feel guilty because you let it happen, even though you didn't let it happen. And I completely agree. I think we are different parents to the parents we should have been. And doing that normal stuff where they say, can I go to a party? And you're like, no. Who's going to be there?
How are you getting there?
But as she's got older, it's been easier to kind of say to her, you know, this is a reaction to our trauma as parents. And what I need for me to feel safe about you is for you to give me the plan.
Yeah.
We need a plan. We need to know where you are. And, you know, it was things like, I look back on it now and I wonder if we were maybe a little bit out of control, but it was stuff like, I wouldn't let her go to somebody's house until they'd been to our house. And I know that's really weird, but until I'd seen this child and I'd looked into their eyes and kind of worked out that they were okay, I wouldn't let her go. And, you know, you would check in on her and stuff like that. And I know she feels suffocated by it sometimes, but she also has learned the hard way that if she just indulges us for a little while, we then kind of realise that it's all okay, and then she can kind of go about her business. You know, it's really difficult.
I think what I'm hearing there as well is, as well as the young people, the children's window of tolerance shrinking, quite clearly, parents' windows of tolerance shrink too. Because, and again, it's all geared towards keeping you safe. Now, you're not going to go to sleepovers. Now, you can't go to that place. And it's keeping, you know, and I think you were also talking, like, there's so many things that you can pull in from all of this. And in terms of the kind of seeing the different behaviours, so you might see your child moving out of their window of tolerance in a really shut down, withdrawn, or I've just got to sleep and hide away from the world for a period of time. And then you might see them the next day or the next week going in the opposite direction and being, you know, very much out there, flighty, doing things, you know, and that can be like really, really difficult. So, yeah, like you were saying, that they might, you might see them going in kind of different directions out of their window of tolerance. So you might see them kind of becoming very withdrawn, hiding away in their bedrooms or just needing to sleep and shutting down and that kind of thing. And that, you know, metaphor of essentially there's got the iceberg with just a little bit sticking out the top and everything else is going on underneath. Or you might see them going in the other direction and being very flighty and all out and everywhere and energised or seemingly energetic, but kind of acting on adrenaline, you know, in terms of that kind of explosive volcano erupting kind of thing. And they can move between those two different states. And like you've said before, they'll need different things to help regulate them. And that's what we talk about more in like subsequent sessions is how to regulate and come back to that window of tolerance. And I guess that's the job for you as parents, isn't it? Is to help bring them back into their window of tolerance when they become really dysregulated, but also to try and help them expand over time that window of tolerance when it gets too small. And
sometimes it's just holding.
Yeah.
It's holding them where they are because they're not ready to move almost in other direction.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like that you're just kind of living with it and managing it as it is until there's a shift.
Yeah.
But I just think being completely open and honest with your children about why you're behaving the way you are as a parent and what your fears are, and you know, you can talk about the reasons why you're feeling like this, because this has happened to your child, it hasn't happened to you. So by you explaining to them that, you know, you're feeling guilty, and they will know that there's no guilt to be played on your part. So by having these conversations with your children, you know, about this is why I'm doing this, then it's opening them up to be honest with you. Like, Mum, I'm not going to go anywhere that's going to, you know, cause this to happen, or I promise I'm just going to go there for an hour and this is what my plan is and then I'll be back. And you can kind of then build on that.
I think it's really important, like those things that you've highlighted as well, is when you're talking about like broadening or shifting or, you know, adjusting to windows of tolerances, it can be really seemingly small things. It's not great leaps, like what you were saying earlier about, you know, it took you a while to work out that actually you just need to give her some space when she comes in and not talk to her for a bit. But actually now you're in a place where you can go, should we just talk about it now? Because I'm going to go to bed. That is a broadening of what she can tolerate, you know, what her, the size of the window of tolerance. Or it may be that before they're just in their room the whole time, but actually just coming down and watching one short TV program, that might be an indicator that somebody is able to tolerate something more. And I think often we think in terms of these like massive things like go back to college or get on a bus by yourself and stuff, and actually I think sometimes looking at just the small shifts, and it goes both ways, and it goes backwards and forwards, and it goes round and round and round, you know.
I think as a parent as well, I know one of the things, before any of this happened, your expectation is that your child's going to go to school, they're going to go on, they're going to get this education. And so to change that mindset from supporting your child not to go to school because that isn't the right thing for them, that's really hard.
Yeah.
So, but then, you know, making peace with that, so no, that's absolutely the right thing for her. Yes, she's a bright child. Yes, she absolutely needs her education. But actually, what good is that to me if she can't function? So, you know, but changing that mindset when you've always thought your child was going to go through school, do these exams, go to uni, and none of that might happen.
And that's a huge adjustment, I guess. But actually what you're demonstrating is that you are fully tuning into what she needs, you know.
And that's okay. I think it's okay to stand your ground against, you know, what the education system are saying, well, your child should be here and needs to be doing this. And, you know, you're actually then saying, this is my child who at this moment in time actually needs nurturing or just needs a day off or just needs a break. You just need to give them some space, because the way you're coming at them with all these rules and things like that, and you know, expecting your child to be in school on time, and you know, sometimes you don't realize that actually it's taken all your strength just to get up and get them in the car that morning, you know. So that the fact that I'm at the school and you know, I'm sorry I'm 5 minutes late, or, you know, I think this is something that the education system needs to kind of take a look at. That is not, we know rules are there for a reason, but sometimes it's okay, and you have to advocate for your child as well, and don't be afraid to actually say, actually, no, this is not what my child needs today. So
I think it's really interesting that we've all taken different routes through that as well. I think there's no right or wrong answer. All you can do is respond with the information that you've got in any given situation. So for us, education's really important, and it was important for her to have somewhere to go that wasn't tainted. And she actually didn't miss a whole lot of school. Did she achieve in the way that we thought that she might one day back in the midst of time? No. But she has completed her education, she's gone off to university, and she's doing stuff. But we were prepared for that not to happen. We spent a lot of time putting a plan around the exams and how that was going to be managed. And there's lots of things that you can do to kind of support your child. And I don't want any parent to think that what they're thinking about doing tomorrow as a plan is necessarily the wrong thing, because we've all done different things and we all do different things with our own children all of the time. It's not a, you make the plan today and that's the plan forever. And, you know, what you don't know is what they're capable of. And, you know, if you support them and nurture them now, they may very well go on to do all of those things. You know, they may do them later. They might go a different room, but they might get there, or they might not.
Yeah.
And they might do something completely different, and that's okay.
Yeah, and that's very true. So she missed it a whole year of school. She's now back in school. She's setting exams this year. She has a plan to go to uni. So, you know, actually, we might have gone about it a different route, might have taken a bit of our diversion, but we're now getting there.
Yeah.
But it's her plan.
It's her plan.
It's not somebody else's plan for her. It's her plan. Exactly. She's ready for it, and that's the important part.
Exactly.
And I think just coming back to the kind of the window bit, just a top tip for parents that helped us with the panic attacks, it's not only helping to soothe her, but also helping her to soothe herself. We made a little box, essentially, and she made it, we facilitated it. And in there, it was things like something really stinky. So for her, it was a Vicks inhaler that floated her boat, you know. She had chocolate in there for after the panic attack had subsided because she was exhausted. She had fidget toys because sometimes she needed to do something physical. And if she wasn't quite up to doing push-ups, which sometimes she would do, you know, fidgeting or doing something with her hands was enough. What else did she have now? Something chewy. So that being able to chew or a drinks bottle with a straw really worked for her. So there's lots and lots of things you can try. And giving her the control over that actually helped her to feel empowered, which meant she was more engaged in using it. It wasn't something we said you must do. It was something she chose to do for herself and seemed to stick a little better, I think.
Because let's not forget, like, the whole window of tolerance, that could be in a very, very short time frame. That could be over a couple of hours. It could be over a couple of days. It could be over a couple of months. You know, each day is different. So, you know, that window of tolerance, it's going to be more of a wave, isn't it? You're just going to get the ups and the downs.
And not to feel disheartened when you get the downs. Because they come. They still come now. They're less frequent and they're less severe, I would say, in terms of how it impacts on the family. But they still come. We just know how to navigate them a bit better than we did yesterday. I think somebody once said to us, it's like you go through something and every time you're kind of going through it, you're learning how to cope with it or not cope with it, as the case may be, but you're learning techniques. And then when the thing happens again, it doesn't mean it's any less impactful, but you've already got skills to deal with it. And so what we've always tried to do is give her skills. So, you know, she's building all of the time on that resilience, on the ability to cope. And, you know, that seems to be helping her move forward. It's not easy. We don't get it right most of the time. You know, we're just normal people muddling through. But, you know,
it makes me think of what we were saying earlier about like your body and your nervous system learning how to respond to certain situations, and it learning are not always useful, like survival response when it doesn't need it. And what you're saying exactly is like almost the opposite kind of learning of, yes, you know, that we're maybe learning those things that aren't helpful, but there's hope that we can relearn things or learn things in a different way that are more helpful. So sometimes you just can't see that, I guess, but what you're saying is you have seen that in your experience, and you've learned to kind of move in a more helpful direction.
Yeah, it takes time.
Yeah.
And when you're in the thick of it, you don't realise you're making any progress at all. But you've made it through the day.
Yeah.
And it hasn't beaten you yet. So you go again tomorrow, don't you? And you try something different, or, you know, you've got to be flexible, which when you're overloaded is probably the hardest thing in the world to be as a parent. But
you've also got to give yourself a break. Like, you know, you're going through something that's unimaginable, and to then beat yourself up over certain things, it's not helpful. It's not helpful for yourself. It's not helpful for anybody else. And you need to be kind to yourself. And, you know, you are only human, and you're going to run on emotions, and no, you're not always going to get it right. But when you do get it right, you know you've got it right.
So this conversation today has been between some of the staff at the greenhouse and some of the parents who have access services at the greenhouse, or whose young people have access. Thank you so much for listening. We're really glad that you are. We'd also possibly love to see you in person if you live in the Bristol, South Gloss, North Somerset or Bath and North East Somerset areas, if that feels right for you. For any more information, we've got tons of stuff on our website, so head to www.the-green-house.org.uk for further info about our services and other services. And if you are kind of worried about yourself or your child, please see your GP or think about contacting your local CAM service. Thanks again for listening, and also have a listen to some of the other conversations we've had.